Thank you for being here this evening. I was asked a few weeks ago to preach in a sermon on the topic of suicide, and I was not especially inclined to do that, which is unusual for me. Generally speaking, if I receive a request, it may take me a week or two, but I'll get around to it unless there's some pressing reason why I couldn't or shouldn't. I was not especially inclined to preach a sermon on suicide for a variety of reasons. Some of them obvious, not the least of which is I don't think I have 35 minutes worth of material on suicide. But I was thinking about it, and I thought that maybe in the bigger picture, a sermon on the value of human life might be appropriate. And because I see suicide and modern day suicide and the various ways people have come up with for destroying themselves these days, some directly, some less directly, I see this as a part of a bigger picture, which is a flee from God and a culture that has left God behind and now that is reaping the consequences of having left God behind. And in fact, we have left God so far behind that the connection between God and such things is lost because people aren't used to looking at God at anything except for maybe being part of the problem. And that's tragic, and it is a self-fulfilling prophecy that left to itself will destroy this culture. I have no doubt of that whatsoever. Now, we're not too far gone yet, and there's a lot of good signs out there. Not everybody has the kind of attitudes that we're going to be talking about a little bit today, and hopefully we don't. But it's good for us to every once in a while back up a little bit and assess who we are and what we are doing here. And revisit some of these basic principles that perhaps 50 years ago we didn't need to reassess. Perhaps 50 years ago or 100 years ago, these matters were so ingrained in our culture that they did not require 35 minutes of pulpit time. Today they do. Hopefully I won't have to do this too very often. But nevertheless, it's a valuable use of our time, I think, here today. And so I encourage you to follow along in your Bibles and make some notes, if you would, to run some of these references. Because the Bible does talk about life and the purpose of life a great deal. And the more we understand what the Bible says about life, I think the better position we're going to be in to properly assess how we respond to life and how we value or do not value life, and perhaps a little bit about how we can be a good example to those who are around us. Let's start with some basics. Let's start with some definitions. What exactly is life? As fundamental as that question may seem, it probably won't take you very long to realize that's actually a relatively complicated concept, especially in the modern day, where exactly when life begins and exactly when life ends and machine-maintained life and surgery on fetuses still in the womb and all kinds of... We're dealing with a completely different world now than we were even 20 years ago, let alone 50 or 100 years ago. And it opens up some definitional difficulties, essentially. And I don't pretend to have all the answers as far as this goes. We're going to try to be relatively basic here and emphasize what the Bible emphasizes. And I think that we're not going to go too far wrong if we stick with that. Life essentially is activity as opposed to inactivity. Life is, and by the way, I'm not going to talk about plant life here. There is an argument that some people make these days that says, in essence, there is no such thing as plant life. There are plants, but plants are not alive. And you can argue semantics all you want, but I think it is an important distinction that plant life is fundamentally different from animal life. There's a very real difference. And as profound as the difference is between plant life, if you will, and animal life, there is an equally and greater profound difference between animal life and human life. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit. But life essentially, especially with regard to us, human beings, we're looking at activity.
We can look at passages like Luke chapter 2, verse 41, where John the Baptist is still in his mother's body, and he leaks, the text says. And those of you who've been pregnant, you know what we're talking about here. Some of your husbands know what we're talking about. There is activity. There is vitality inside the woman's body that is separate from the woman's life. Obviously, they're attached, literally and metaphorically. But they are different. And although the health of the one may affect the health of the other, does affect the health of the other, they are distinct. And anybody would agree with that. Even the most vitriolic of atheists would agree with that. Similarly, in Genesis chapter 25, verse 22, Rebecca is starting to wonder if maybe this whole giving birth thing was a mistake, because she's got two of the little critters in there, and they're fighting with one another. And apparently this is kind of a lifelong thing. They're going to spend the next 70-plus years fighting with each other, and she's distressed because they are struggling with each other. And exactly what that means and exactly how different that is than the regular childbirth process or the regular birthing of twins process is, we're not in a position to say. But clearly it was a almost violent kind of thing that was going on inside of her body, because these two human beings, again, more on that in a second, were individually fighting for their own supremacy, as it were. And the birth story of Jacob and Esau brings that out. Even in the actual birth itself, they're still fighting for supremacy. And that, of course, characterized their entire life. More basic than that, though, and perhaps more conceptual than that, I think it's important for us to emphasize life as being a gift from God. That this is what God has given us. And it's worth noting here in passing that even in the modern day, scientists are baffled at the concept of life. Life makes no sense. There is, if you're talking about human beings or animals, there is the male aspect and there's the female aspect, and they could join. And suddenly, this thing comes to life. This thing takes activity in and of itself that did not exist before. Similar things happen with plants. A seed goes into the ground, and just like Jesus says in the parable, the seed sprouts, and the farmer does not know how. It just happens. It just does. And we can provide conditions that will help it happen, or conditions that will keep it from happening, but essentially we have nothing to do with this process. We don't know how it starts. We don't know why it starts. We just know when it starts, and under what circumstances it might be encouraged to start. That's it. And the answer, of course, if you believe the Bible, if you believe in God, these scientific questions ultimately get resolved very simply and very quickly. Well, God gave us life. You know, God made us alive. God's the one that makes the plants sprout, and God's the one that causes the animals in the field to bear. And God brings us into this world also. Genesis chapter 2 and verse 7 speaks of human beings, that Adam at this point is literally dirt, and God breathes into his mouth and he becomes a living soul. And that's maybe the most obvious example, but it's, you can talk about any human being that's ever lived, and essentially the same thing happens. There is matter reasonably organized in some fashion, and then God works on it and it becomes alive. The more we think about God as being the originator of life, I think the more simple the rest of this starts to fall into place. The idea of us just kind of doing what we want with our life, or not doing what we want, or what have you. When we think of life as being a gift to us from God, a bequest, a blessing from God, our responsibility to place it in its proper context, to use it in its proper way, its designated way, makes a lot more sense. And I'm suggesting here that it is to be spent in thankfulness for what it is, and not spent in regret for what it is not. And we'll talk a little bit more about personal motivations and abuses of this process as we go along. But for our purposes here, just emphasize, if you find yourself questioning life and questioning your purpose or what have you, I suggest to you that you haven't spent enough time thinking about God. And if you will back up a little bit and think about the life that you have as being a gift from God, the question not becomes far less about how good can my life be, or how good should my life be, or why isn't my life any better than it is, or as good as the fellow down the street, or anything like that. It becomes much, much less like that, and much more about how marvelous it is that God has chosen to do this for me, and that giving me life is also giving me all these other accoutrements of life. And therefore, I'm to spend that life, whatever quality it is, however much quantity there may be of it, we spend it in thankfulness, appreciating who we are, appreciating where we came from, and reserve considerably less time in our lives for contemplation of what our life ought to be, or what our life should be, or what we deserve somehow from God or from whatever. Now, having discussed that, let's talk about humans a little bit. Because there is a difference between life and human life. And the Bible teaches that. Human life is living, in the conventional sense, but not animal. And we have been sold a bill of goods by the scientific community out there, some of which claims to be Christian. And many of the founding fathers, as it were, you go back to Linnaeus and people like that, who, at least on the surface, had some kind of regard for God, but trained us to think of life here on earth not so much in terms of God made this and God made that and God made something else, but rather a kingdom of animals, all of which are somehow attached to each other. And if it did not happen immediately, it happened pretty close after that, that human beings got put in that tree somewhere. And before too long, we are thinking of ourselves as being part of this grand whole, which is a concept that was never taught in the Bible, that God never disclosed to us. God never calls human beings animals. Sometimes he does, but when they're acting like animals, in a metaphorical sense. And we do the same thing. But God does not portray human beings as part of the animal world. He portrays us as being separate and superior to the animal world. We are made above the animals. We are not made chief among the animals. A very important point. And we'll probably touch on the so-called animal rights philosophy these days, which is basically founded upon this, that life is life and it doesn't make any difference what form it takes or how many legs they have or how big their brain pan is. It doesn't make any difference. We're all essentially the same sort of protoplasm. Some of us got a little bit more lucky than others, but it's all essentially the same kind of thing. That's all atheism. That's all the idea of organic atheistic evolution. That's where all this comes from. And the Bible, again, teaches from the very beginning that we are not supposed to think of ourselves as animals. He tells Adam in Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, we read from Genesis chapter 9 a little bit earlier, and Noah is given the same commission. He is also separated from the animal world. He is in charge of it. He is not a part of it. And beyond that, though, and most of the time when we talk about what a human being is from a Bible perspective, this is what I talk about, and I think this is what we should talk about. That human beings are made in the image of God. You're aware of the quotation from Genesis chapter 1 and verse 26 and 27. This was the plan of God to make man in God's image, and that's exactly what happened. Male and female, both of them created after the image of God. And you've probably heard many, many sermons as to all the spiritual applications and implications of that. We'll touch on a couple of things here this evening. Being a human being means being self-aware, being aware of who we are and able to contemplate that reality. I'm aware there are stories about gorillas being able to recognize photographs of themselves as opposed to other gorillas and things of that nature. Exactly how deeply we can get into the animal mind, I think we're kind of fooling ourselves a little bit as far as that goes. I'm not an animal psychologist, so maybe I'm not the person to ask about that. I will go on the record of saying this, that the level of awareness, however much may exist in the more intelligent animals out there, dolphins or gorillas or dogs or whatever, whatever level of awareness exists in those is light years away from the level of awareness that occurs in human beings. That we not only know who we are, not only do we distinguish ourselves from our environment, from other human beings, we are able to form our own future, form our own reality, as it were, to create a future for ourselves in prospect, a plan to engage the future in prospect. Morality is a God concept that, for practical purposes, does not exist in the animal world. I'm aware that you know, you see elephant funerals, for instance, and the baby elephant has died, and the mother goes and comforts the dead baby and wraps it up with her trunk, and it's a very touching kind of scene. And other animals do that kind of thing also. I understand that. Those are emotions. And to a certain extent, some animals do appear to have emotions. Emotions and morality are very, very different. Morality means a sense of right and wrong. Not simply acting out of instinct, not acting out of your nature, but rather doing the right thing because you know what the right thing is as opposed to the wrong thing. This is a human aspect, and we got it from God, from being made in His image. To a certain extent, I think also Ecclesiastes 3, verse 11, the idea of having eternity being placed in our hearts, I think that's part of being in the image of God as well, that we know that there is more to life than what we have here on this earth. There has always been a sense of that. You have to go all the way to the 20th century. Before you find any significant human civilization at all that didn't believe in the afterlife. We all understood that more existed after this. And I don't doubt for a second that this mythology that exists among the Egyptians or the Norwegians or among the Greeks or Romans or what have you, that this is a corrupted, twisted, mangled version of the truth that God gave human beings in the Garden of Eden. That has always been true, that we have an accountability on an eternal scale. Now, I don't have to be an animal psychologist to know that animals don't think like that. I have an animal in my house. I watch Max's priorities. Max is not concerned about the afterlife. Max is concerned about where his food is. Concerned about getting scratched. You know, getting proper appreciation for all the rhinos that he chases away from our house. He's a very short-term thinker. That's what he does. That's all that he does. It's all he's capable of doing. If he doesn't set a 401k plan up for himself, I don't get stressed out about that. That's not in his nature. Human beings are different. Human beings understand not just about the present and the past and the future, but also we understand about eternity. Now, that having been said, we have human beings and we have life. So we have human life. And the reason human life has value that we're discussing here is that we understand what it is and where it comes from. The giver himself, the one who distributes life, he himself is valuable. Maybe some of you have, we have a visitor with us here this evening who has a I was in Brother Gerald's house in Kentucky, and he showed me all these great things that he's picked up from all over the world, and he's got a photograph of five presidents, all of which had signed it, which is an extremely rare kind of thing. And where you get something has an impact on how valuable it is, right? If you were given something by the president, or if you're giving something by Mickey Mantle or Howard Hughes, or whoever you think is an important person, whatever kind of role model you might have, if this came directly from them, and maybe they put their name on it, maybe they had a conversation with you about it, the source of this thing, whatever it is, lends a whole other dimension of value to it, doesn't it? Well, that's what life is. When we understand that life is a gift from God, we realize how truly marvelous it is. And getting to the flip side to this a little bit early here, if you don't do that, if you don't think of life as being a gift from God, if it's just what you have, if you don't think about where you came from, if you don't think about where you're going, if you're just spinning your wheels for 70, 80, 90 years, whatever, and then you die,
It's not difficult to imagine why your sense of accountability, why your sense of morality, why your sense of proper, decent behavior and responsibility and such, why that might deteriorate. Because we have separated life from God. And now it's just what we want. It has nothing to do with God anymore because we don't acknowledge God anymore. The purpose that God has given us in life is a valuable purpose. We realize not only are we here, not only were we put here, but we're put here for a reason, for a series of reasons that we're going to touch on in brief here. We're put here to serve God, obviously. Ecclesiastes 12, verse 13 and 14. That this is who we are. This is what we're supposed to be doing. Fear God and keep His commandments. Verse 13 is probably the one that we usually quote. And God will bring us into judgment for when we do not properly distribute, properly dispose of this life that He's given to us. This is who we are. This is what we're supposed to be doing. And it's no surprise that when people leave the purpose for their life out, their life suddenly seems purposeless. Similarly, serving others. Now, some people came into this on their own. Some people figured out on their own, without any help from God, that my life is a lot more meaningful when I put others before myself. Well, good for you. That's good. God could have gotten you there a lot easier and a lot quicker if you'd read the Bible. But you got there on your own. That's okay. But we as Christians, we as people who believe in God, see our life of service to our fellow man as being more than simply feeling really good about ourselves and sleeping really good at night and feeling like we're good people and better than these other slackers who don't serve other people. It's not that. It's not nearly that. We understand that by serving other people, we emulate the character of God. We become serving to others in the same way that God was a servant to us. And so it is our joy to submit to one another. In the fear of the Lord, in the fear of Christ, as Paul writes in Ephesians, chapter 5, verse 21. This is what we do. This is what we want to do. When we have opportunity to serve somebody, to build up their interest instead of simply using our life to serve our own interests, we realize that our life is a lot more meaningful than it would have been otherwise. And of course, ultimately, we're talking about pursuing heaven. We're talking about using this life to prepare for the next life. There are a lot of people who use work along those lines. Since we started living into our 80s and 90s and such, people of my generation, maybe a generation before, realized, it makes a whole lot of sense for me to be spending the next, years 25 through 65, 40 years of my life, use that in preparation for what's going to happen to me after I turn 65. If I can put enough money in the bank, if I can make good, reasonable investments, if I can cross my T's and dot my I's, then maybe after my work life is over, I'll be in position for retirement life, and then I'll be able to really live the kind of life that I want to live instead of living the life that I have to live. And I think it's a very reasonable way of looking at things, if you have confidence that you're going to live to be 65 and beyond. Now, it doesn't always work that way, of course, but that's the way we think. And that's not a bad thing. In fact, when you put that in a universal perspective, when you put that in an eternity perspective, it makes even more sense. Because God is essentially asking us to do the same thing. Except instead of giving Him 40 years, or 45 years, or 50 years, He's asking for all of it. You give me this life. And you invest it with me. You give yourself to me during this period of time. And after this life is over, I will give you an eternity. I will give you an eternity in heaven. That is the essence of what Paul is writing about in Philippians chapter 3. And verse number 20 and 21. Where Paul writes here, "For our citizenship is in heaven, from which we eagerly wait for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who will transform the body of our humble state into conformity with the body of His glory by the exertion of the power that He has even to subject all things to Himself." Now there's a sort of a twist here. Because if you're jumping ahead of me here a little bit, you may get the notion that living to yourself, just doing what you want to do, by its very nature, you get a lot more cool stuff than if you give your life to Jesus Christ. And there's some truth to that.
If you're investing only in yourself, 100% involved in yourself, and you don't give yourself at all to God, then you have more in this life. That's the way most of our materialistic neighbors think. We would expect them to think that way if they leave God out of the picture. But Paul says that's not how we think. We invest in heaven. Our citizenship is in heaven, he says. And we have confidence because we have faith. We have confidence that Jesus is going to take this life and transform it into a different kind of life, a life that we can barely even contemplate, let alone properly understand. But we accept it by faith. That's where our citizenship is. And so therefore we are prepared, and in fact we are eager to turn this life over to God. And by the way, that's not nearly as miserable a prospect as sometimes it's made out to be, or perhaps as I've made it out to be in the last few minutes. It's a marvelous thing to live our lives in Jesus Christ. But the most marvelous thing about it is the realization that we are investing in our eternal future, that we are pursuing heaven. And it's worth noting here, also, along these same lines, you only get one. You know, a lot of times we play these games with ourselves, right? Your house is burning down. You can go in your house and save one thing. What are you going to save? Or maybe you have a photo album that's near and dear to you. And for whatever reason, you're only allowed to keep one photograph. You're only allowed to keep one book. You're only allowed to watch one television program for the rest of your life, whatever it happens to be. Only watch one movie. For me, it'd be Lawrence of Arabia because it's great and it's long. So that would be my one. You'd pick that rather carefully, don't you think? If there's only going to be one, I better make sure I make a good choice. And the Hebrew writer tells us in Hebrews 9, verse 27, that it is appointed a man once to die, and after this comes judgment. And it's not really the main point that he's getting at, but this is the passage that oftentimes we'll go to emphasize the singularity of life. You go around one time. The modernists are right about that. You do only go around once. Doesn't it make sense to use that one life that you have, the only life that you have, in the right way? In the best way possible. You don't have to do that. You can see how many beers you can drink. That could be your life. You can see how many tattoos you can get. You know, whatever. People define a great life in all kinds of different crazy ways these days. But if we define it like God does, if we invest in heaven, and if we truly believe that really the only reasonable thing to do with this life is to serve God, then that's exactly what we will do. Because we have come to realize what our life is, where our life comes from, what the reason for all of it is. Now, having said all that, we'll touch on a few of the points that I actually wanted to talk about. There are people in our society who don't value life. And this has all kinds of examples. And we're going to try not to get any more gruesome than we absolutely have to here. But it all goes back to what we've been talking about. If you appreciate what life is, where life came from, the purpose of all of these things, then hopefully we can distance ourselves from all these horrible, horrific things that we see in our society that are directly attributable, I would argue, to a diminution of God's purpose in our life, God's involvement in our life, God's existence at all. The less we think about God in connection with life, the less important our life gets. Less important life in general gets, and the more atrocious our life gets. It's kind of interesting when you think about it in a weird, twisted sort of way. We are told that the only reasonable way to live your life is to live it up, to completely forget all of this heaven stuff. That's what John Lennon told us back in the 70s, right? Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. That's what you do. Just forget about all this pie in the sky kind of stuff and just focus on making yourself as happy as you possibly can. Use this life completely and totally for yourself. And people do that and they destroy themselves. They make themselves miserable. Specifically because they did exactly what they were told to do to avoid being miserable. It'd be funny if it wasn't so sad. The concept of life gets completely twisted and mangled. What is, in fact, life? What does it mean to be alive? And I don't care to get into a big question here about at what point an embryo or fetus or whatever becomes a human being. And I certainly have my ideas on that topic. I'd be glad to share it. Probably will share it with you at some other point. But the idea that it's okay to flush a 2/3 to 9/10 form human being out of its mother's body, and just mangle it and chop it up and throw it down the toilet, that's not that big a deal. Unless you can maybe sell it for parts, which is even better. How do we get to that point? This is how we get to that point. Because we are ignoring what a human being is. We're ignoring what life is. The same thing goes for euthanasia. Kind of the opposite end of the not respecting life spectrum. For 100 more years, there have been very serious people, and they're becoming more and more prominent these days, who think that old people ought to just get out of the way. You've had your time. You're just occupying space. All you're doing is converting oxygen into carbon dioxide, taking up resources. You're in the way of the young people who can actually help society, who can actually help do things and build up our culture, build up our revenue stream and all that kind of thing. The old, you know, once you pass whatever the number is, 65, 75, 85, whatever. Once you pass that number, then just, you know, go to a clinic and they'll assign you a pill and you go home and, you know, hug your family and that's it. There are very real, very serious efforts along these lines these days. Why? Because life's not valuable. Their life isn't valuable. Now, we have a few septuagenarians, octogenarians in the house here, and I think they would probably argue that their life is valuable. That there's something meaningful, and I certainly hope you think that. Because your life is a gift from God. And if you realize that God has given you this, now maybe you're not making the best use of it, and maybe you can work on that a little bit. But surely if this life is given to you by God, then there is purpose for it. There's a reason for it. We can talk about animal rights too. You know, and I put rights in quotation marks here because I deny vehemently that animals have rights or that they should have rights. And this is why. Because animals aren't human beings. Rights is a human being's concept. But we have trained ourselves to think of human beings as being animals and animals being just like us. And look at the cute chimpanzee. Doesn't he look all human and all of this? And you know, the pandas, you know, kind of look like the human faces and all this. And so therefore we treat the animals like humans and we treat the humans like animals. And before too long, we raise up a generation, my generation, that has been told over and over again in public schools, in universities, that they are essentially animals. Well, no, essentially to it. They are animals. They're a little bit more self-aware than the other animals, but animals nevertheless, and then they go out in the world and they act like animals. Well, why should we be surprised at that? That's what we're telling them to do. That's what we're telling them is their nature to do. And so here we are. And we have a generation of people coming up these days who have never heard anything else. Because their parents and their grandparents gave up on God a long time ago. And now the idea of pursuing some kind of real, Bible-based, God-centered lifestyle is completely foreign to them. And they're going to take the animalistic aspect of life that they were brought up on. They're going to double down on it when they get off to college. We deny God's role. What part God has to play in this life. Whether there even is a God. There's a fancy word that I looked up today called nihilism. If you want to have a picture of a nihilist, think about these teenagers in goth. You know, they're going around all depressed all the time. What are you doing? I'm dying. Why are you dying? I don't know. What's the purpose of life? There is no purpose. There's no meaning. And this is a rather extreme version of atheism, essentially. That God has been taken out of life. And remember, as we've already argued, God is life. God is the purpose of life. And you decide you're going to have some kind of life outside of God, and somehow you manage to figure out what nobody else has figured out. That life really is meaningless without all this. Nihilism makes a lot of sense if you're an atheist. Yes, life is meaningless. And you're just going to live however long you live, and then you're going to die, and then what's the point of any of it? Well, when you take God out of the equation, there is no point in any of it. And it's a lot worse than having to deal with a lot of depressed young people, which is bad enough. It's worse than that. It's dealing with a generation of people who think that they are absolutely wasting the resources of the planet, are wasting the air that they breathe, the time that they have, that none of it makes any sense. And then the suicide rates goes up and we wonder how in the world that happened. It happened because we've convinced each other that life doesn't matter. That life is irrelevant. That life is pointless. Moral relativism along the same lines. You know, who's to say there's good and bad? Who's to say that there's evil and righteousness and all of this. Somehow or another, we managed to come around to the idea that the Nazis are evil. I don't know where we got that exactly, but the Nazis are evil. White slave owners back 150 years ago, they were evil. But other than that, there's no morality. Because if we acknowledge the existence of morality, we have to acknowledge God, because we can't have morality generate itself and be valid, because how can my morality be any more important, any more valid than your morality? And if we differ, who's right? Nobody's right. Most of the scientific eggheads along these lines of thought have figured that out. And so they don't get worked up about right and wrong. They don't get worked up about good and evil, obeying laws, not obeying laws, being faithful to your spouse, telling the truth, whatever. None of that matters. They do it if they feel like it. Don't do it if they don't feel like it. That's the result of a godless upbringing. That's the result of a godless worldview. And along the same lines here, if we simply look at life, and I'm talking to Christians here too, because it's very easy to slip into this mentality without becoming an atheist. If we slip into this mentality where we think that life is simply about the things we have, the things we do, the things that we say, how many followers we have on Instagram, if that's what our life is, and we leave God out of it, before too long, you will realize that life is meaningless or disappointing, crushing. Life is not intended to be measured by your accomplishments or by your assets or by anything else of a physical nature. And if you go down this materialistic road with your friends and neighbors, I guess I'm talking to the young people here primarily, but the same thing's true for those who are not quite so young. If you go down this philosophical road with your neighbors, with your friends out there in the world, if you value the things that they value, if you devalue the things that they devalue, you're going to ultimately find out that you're dissatisfied with your life. If your parents haven't told you this yet, kids, allow me to break the news to you. Life is full of disappointments. Bad stuff happens. Happens every day. If you have some grand vision of your life, how your life's going to turn out when you're 14, 15, 16 years old, that's fine. We all have that. And I hate to be just the crushing voice of reality here, but the fact of the matter is, it's not going to turn out that way. That may turn out to be a good thing. You may find a better reality for yourself than that. But it's going to be different. I assure you it's going to be different. And along the line, you're going to have your heart broken. People are going to stab you in the back. It's going to be disappointing. You're going to wake up one day and realize that your life is not what it ought to be. It's not what you wish it were. It's not what your buddy's life is. And then what are you going to do? Well, if you have your core,
if you have your focus on God, if you realize what your life really is, what it's really constituted of, not these things, but spiritual things, faith and hope and love, relationship with God, relationship with your brethren, that these are the things that are really important, and you have those things. If you can retreat into your core, then your life stabilizes. And maybe you'll still fret a little bit that you didn't get the job that you wanted or get into the college that you were applying to or whatever, but you move past that because you realize that's not really what your life was. It never was. If you don't have your core, if you don't spend quality time reflecting on your relationship with God. And I'm not talking about coming to church services. I hope and pray that you do come to church services. That's a good first step, but that's not what I'm talking about. You can come to church services your entire life and not have a relationship with God. I'm talking about truly devoting yourself to God, defining your life the way God defines your life. If you can do that, then you're never going to be found wanting. If you do retreat into your core. If you don't, you're always going to be wanting. The reason that we have wars, the main reason that we have wars, certainly in the modern day, is because people are dissatisfied with what they have. They want something that somebody else has. That's essentially what it boils down to. In the movie, General Patton said that war was the greatest endeavor of human race. I don't know if he genuinely said that or genuinely thought that. That makes me cringe, the idea that war is an inherently good thing. It's a noble pursuit. Sometimes war is necessary. The Bible has references to wars. God made wars from time to time. But the idea of choosing this, because you value what you have more than you value the life of somebody on the other side of the world, it is a horrific concept. Suicide, again, same kind of thing. Hedonism, indulging in the flesh to the nth degree. If you think that your life is about people being nice to you, or people treating you fairly, or people giving you stuff, or even allowing you to work for stuff, if you think that's what your life is, then what's going to happen on the day that you don't get it? Because that day will come. Excuse the extreme pontificating here, but I fear for the modern generation. I really do. I'm not talking specifically about our young people here, but the idea that our children could be reared in an environment where God is ignored, where the consequences of ignoring God are blamed on God. And we as parents sit idly by and let it happen is horrifying to me. Parents, we have an obligation. I would like to think that I wouldn't have to put this on you, that you would feel it yourself. But if you don't put it on yourself, then I'll put it on you. We have an obligation to teach our children what life is. To teach them to value their life on their good days and on their bad days. To not allow them to wallow. To not allow them to grieve over the horrible circumstances that they're embroiled in their short-term, very, very small lives. And maybe they'll get tired of us asking, hey, have you prayed about it? What does the Bible say about that? I don't doubt that if you say that every, two or three times a week to your average 14, 15, 16-year-old, they're gonna start ignoring that. I don't doubt it. Keep saying it. Don't quit. They may ignore you when they're 16, but they'll remember you when they're 21. They'll remember you when you're 25.
continue to emphasize how precious these lives are, including the lives that God's placed in our hands. The little life that Eric's holding back there. We're not going to get another one. So let's use it in his service. And while we are using it, let's glorify him in it. And let's rejoice at the privilege that is ours to be children of God, to be created in his image, and to one day depart this eminently flawed existence and move on to something else, something far, far better. We're going to give you an opportunity to lean on the Lord a little bit harder this evening, if that is your need. If there's something we can do to help you, if there's something we do to pray with you about, if there is any way that you are departing from Jesus Christ and you acknowledge that and you don't want that to be the case and you think that we can help with that regard, please allow us to help in whatever way we possibly can. While we stand and singing to encourage you, please, would you come?